This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, August 12th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. The 2012 Fayetteville Roots Festival is Thursday, August 23rd through Sunday, the 26th. This festival of roots music, local food, and Ozark culture will feature over 35 performers, including John Prine, David Grisman Folk Jazz Trio, Daryl Scott, and more. Tickets and information are available on the web at FayettevilleRootsFestival.com.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, how local residents are using technology to track the weather and fencing, the sport, in northwest Arkansas. But first, in the 82 years since Colonel William Pogue was born, the world has seen an incredible change in aviation technology. In 1930, the thought of taking a flight in a plane was just a dream for most.
Today, it's almost like riding a bus. I recently visited with Colonel William Pogue at his home in Bella Vista. A man who worked with NASA during the Apollo years, lived on Skylab, and walked in space.
Always wanted to fly. Everyone said, did you aspire to be an astronaut? Well, when I was young, there was no such career field.
But there were planes.
There were planes, lots of planes.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to fly.
That's Colonel William Pogue, who spent 3 months aboard Skylab in 1973. He is now retired and living in Bella Vista. One of an elite group of people living right here. As he said, there was no space program when he was growing up in the 1930s and 40s, and flying was expensive. His first flight cost him $15. As a janitor, he made just $30 a month, but he considered it money well spent.
Well, I had just turned 16. So I went over there and took a flight in a Piper Cub, J3 Cub. Little 40 horsepower engine in it, but it seemed like that was really uptown.
Born and raised in Oklahoma, Pogue joined the Air Force right after college. It was the beginning of the Korean War. He knew that he wanted to learn to fly, so to avoid being drafted, he enlisted in the Air Force. He lucked out in January of 1951 when he went to Lackland Air Force Base for basic training, and on to flight school, then combat training. He went to Korea in March of 1953, where he flew 43 combat missions before the war ended that July. After Korea, Pogue says that he lucked out again. Of all the people at K2 Base in Korea, he was one of few who were chosen to go to Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. Others went to less desirable locations. Being sent to Luke allowed him the opportunity to try out for the Thunderbirds, an air demonstration team using aerobatics for shows. They used a different type of plane that he was used to flying, and he didn't think that he stood a chance.
Well, I didn't know it, but they weren't looking for people who could already fly the airplane. They were looking for people that wanted to fly the airplane. And I told my wife, I said, I don't think I have a chance, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. At least I'll get to fly the F-84F, and if nothing else. So anyway, so okay. Figured it was a lost cause.
But it wasn't. He got the job and flew all over the United States putting on shows. But by 1957, his wife was about to give birth to their third child, so he resigned from the Thunderbirds. He decided he would go on to graduate school so that he could teach math at the Air Force Academy.
Because, I knew that we were in this sort of propaganda war with the communist nations, and I didn't figure anyone was dumb enough to start a nuclear war, because nobody wins. I thought that I'd like to do that and so I could prepare for another career.
And it did help him prepare for another career, one with NASA. Had he not gone to graduate school, he would not have made it through the selection process to become an astronaut. And it was there that he heard about NASA and the first round of astronauts selected. He was selected in the fifth round when he was 35. The first step in the process was the physical, which Pogue says was the hardest part, 10 days of tests.
Well, the one that I remember best was they had this box of ice water. And they said you had to put your arm in it from the hands up to the elbow in ice water. And I'm telling you, that doesn't sound like it's so bad, but boy, that hurts. And what it does, it gives you cardiovascular stress. And of course, you're there watching the instruments that they have on you. And so I was so tempted to pull my arm out of the water, except I knew I was going to have to put it right back in and start timing all over again. This took about 2 minutes, I think.
He passed.
No, we went right into training.
Okay.
They taught us about space, this and that and the other, but mostly they were technical courses, and the systems courses that covered all the spacecraft that they had at that time, which we were getting the Apollo ready. It didn't take a genius to pass the courses, but you had to know that to be able to operate the equipment.
Pogue worked on many support crews for Apollo while he awaited assignment, even serving as a backup for Apollo 16.
With the idea that my crew, our crew, Jerry Carb and Ed Gibson and me, would fly the Apollo 19 next to the last one scheduled. When 18, 19, and 20 were canceled, then Deke came to us and said, well, you're not going to fly on Apollo. And he said, why would you like to fly Skylab? And we said, yay, you know, anything. Because that was it. That was the only game in town.
After 3 years of training, Pogue and his two other crew members launched on an Apollo spacecraft. The day was November 16, 1973. They were the third mission to Skylab, the first space station. Life in space was still very unknown. Skylab's purpose was to perform experiments and investigations in three areas, the first being the sun. Pogue says that some of the things they discovered regarding solar flares and the solar corona were quite novel. The second area of study was the Earth, 270 miles below Skylab. They flew over the same swath of land every 5 days, documenting their observations and conducting comparative studies. He enjoyed both of these areas.
The third area wasn't so much fun. That third area was us. We were test subjects for a wide range of physiological tests, which some weren't so fun, much fun. We had a lower body negative pressure device, and what you get, it looked like a 50-gallon drum. You slipped your feet after they put instrumentation on you and all that. in the lower part of this thing, in a seal, a sort of a diaphragm seal around your abdomen, and they started lowering the pressure on your legs, and it started pulling the blood from your head down in toward your legs, and would cause you to pass out if you took it far enough. We had a big red handle, they call it a chicken switch, and if you felt yourself about ready to pass out, you'd hit that one, and it would repressurize the lower part. But they said, I couldn't understand it. It almost seemed sadistic.
And it didn't bother you?
Yeah, it bothered me. I some of those medical tests I didn't particularly like, but there was a good reason and rationale for it.
They also studied how the lack of gravity affected metabolism. Pogue says he was convinced it was different because he was always hungry, even though they were on a 2,800 calorie a day diet of what he says was very good food: frozen salmon, pop-top fruit, coffee, and tea. He actually gained weight during their 84 days aboard Skylab. He took two spacewalks during his time there, one on Thanksgiving Day and one on Christmas Day, that one breaking a record for the longest spacewalk. He was out for just over 7 hours. He says he was only scared once, during their return to Earth. The spacecraft was designed for only 2 weeks in space. It had been docked on Skylab for almost 3 months, but they made it. Pogue eventually resigned from NASA. He, along with friend and colleague Jerry Carr, moved to land they had purchased in Madison County. Not one, but two astronauts living in Arkansas. He and Carr went to work for the Boeing company.
I was called a technical services subcontractor. Jerry and I had contracts with the Boeing company to give them support during their design of the International Space Station. And so that was really an interesting job.
So were you able to live here and then travel to Boeing?
Yes, yes. Okay. Eventually bought a plane so Gene could go with me. And we...
Gene being his beloved wife he lost in 2009. When he retired from Boeing in 1998, the two traveled the nation, Pogue giving over 500 presentations to school children about life in space. In this day and age, it seems that kids and people have lost an interest in space. But he says the younger ones are still curious. Recent years have seen massive budget cuts to NASA programs, space shuttles grounded indefinitely. And how does that make Pogue feel?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, our leadership is missing. Absent.
How, what do you foresee the future to be?
Well, you have to go back and see what happened. When the budgets were all whacked to pieces and projects canceled, okay, then what you do is you lose your trained cadre. And what you're left with are graybeards and greenhorns. So you have the mixture in your personnel. It's all warped. And so I'm not very optimistic about a turnaround in our space program, because even if you had some known as gung-ho, they've lost their guts. They've lost the people who have made it all happen. It's heartbreaking, really.
And as for Pogue's future, he'll soon be moving to Florida, not far from the Kennedy Space Center, where he plans to spend some time talking with visitors. Colonel William Pogue resides in Bella Vista. He authored books, including How Do You Go to the Bathroom in Space and But for the Grace of God. For more information, www.williampogue.com.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Katie Hendrickson, who you hear on KUAF Monday through Friday at 11 o'clock with UpNote, and also tonight, right?
Yes. We've just started the KUAF Sunday Symphony. I started it last week, and we'll be doing it every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m., and we're featuring the larger symphonies that I can't possibly play on UpNote.
In fact, tonight, a Shostakovich symphony that could not fit into your one-hour program.
That's right. It's Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony, the 7th Symphony, and it's almost 79 minutes long, so there's absolutely no way I could possibly fit that in there.
And that is his longest symphony?
It's his longest. It's a very personal symphony. He grew up in Leningrad, and he wrote it right in 1941 when the Nazis took over Leningrad. So it's a very personal symphony, and it's also very expansive. It's actually featuring, this recording features the Kirov Orchestra and the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra. So it needs a lot of instruments. It's just very, very expansive. And that, what happened was, as far as symphonies go, once you get into the late Romantic period and beyond, there's all these new instruments, and things just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So you know, early on, full symphonies were only 25 minutes long, and then you get to late Romantic and beyond, and they get to be almost 2 hours long.
Wow. Sunday Symphony began last Sunday. It will always, the title says this, but it will always feature a symphony, at least one.
Yeah, it features, the idea is to feature and focus on the symphony, but it is a two-hour program, so that means, last week I happened to be able to fit three symphonies into the two-hour slot perfectly, which was really awesome, but sometimes I'll fill it in with other kinds of music, but the idea is to focus on the symphony, but, you know, also play other kinds of classical music.
How do you know which symphony? There are thousands. How are you going? I guess in the early going, you've got a whole world to pick from.
Yeah, right now it's easy. There's so many. It's just like with any of the, when I put together UpNote or anything, I go into our music library, I just pull all these CDs, and I just listen to them. I'm like, oh, this is really awesome. I really want to play this today. And I think about what I'm playing in, like, time periods, about different types of composers and where they're from. I put all of that into my brain to come up with like a really eclectic programming. So it's not, I don't know, you I pair things that I feel like work together, but they don't necessarily have to all sound the same. So sometimes I'll pair an early work with a 20th century masterwork or something like that.
So any idea of what else you will play tonight with Shostakovich?
I'm not sure. That's something I have to figure out. Last week I ended up, I think, with a very Germanic heavy program. So this week, I've got Shostakovich, so Russian. I'm trying to think of some other pairings. I was thinking a Dvorak symphony might go good with it.
And this is 2 hours of music, just almost all music. So there's the newscast isn't there. This is something you used to hear on public radio decades ago. But, as the format of radio has kind of become more compartmentalized. So this is just – Sunday night's a perfect time for this. I can just imagine turning on the Victrola, the old the RCA radio and sitting back.
It's a perfect Sunday night activity for anyone to do. Just turn on the radio or, if you're streaming it online on your computer. It's Sunday evening. Everyone's getting ready for the work week. It's a great time to kind of pause and contemplate and just get into that symphony.
There's the difference in generations. I was thinking Victrola or an old RCA radio. You said, or if you're streaming, which is true, of course. All right, 7 to 9 tonight.
Yes.
And can you come back next week and tell us a little bit about what you're going to play next week?
I'll come back next week and talk about next week's program, too.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Katie Hendrickson, Sunday Symphony, tonight from 7 to 9, and of note, every Monday through Friday at 11.
Earlier this week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda visited Fencing Center in Bentonville to learn more about the sport. Today, she looks at how the center came to be, as well as the organization's foundation.
I'll show you how it's supposed to be, because you go like a metronome.
Yeah.
So, guys, randomly, you have to be a stagger.
Earlier this week, I met Adrian Kolchiska, a coach at the Northwest Arkansas Fencing Center. During our conversation, he told me about his life as a fencer in Romania, which made me curious as to how he wound up in our little corner of the world. The person largely responsible for the relocation is Laura Kirk. She met Adrian because of her 15-year-old daughters, a pair of twins, who were interested in learning to fence.
They had been through every more common sport, I guess I should say, more accessible sport. And when they were done, pretty much with everything, we said, is there anything else you want to try? And this is kind of funny when people give kids playing video games a hard time. Because of Legend of Zelda, my kids decided that they wanted to try sword fighting. And so they were like, that just looks really cool. And they thought it looked great. And so, we kind of researched where we could try it, and they took an intro class.
The sport just became a bigger part of Laura's family after that. Laura and her husband started taking lessons, and their daughters began participating in competitions. Laura says once the girls switched from recreational to competitive fencing, they needed a coach. Adrian was recommended, but the problem was he was located in Phoenix, Arizona. That actually worked out for Laura's family because her husband's job allowed him to work from Phoenix. Laura homeschooled her daughters, and for 2 years, they traveled back and forth between Northwest Arkansas and Phoenix, either by car or plane, to continue training. Eventually, Laura asked Adrian to consider moving to Northwest Arkansas. He agreed and has been here for about a year. One of the conditions of him moving was having the ability to work with a foundation. So Laura helped establish the Northwest Arkansas Fencing Foundation and is the organization's executive director.
So Adrian was willing to take the chance. We started with, one small pot of money, and then we have the center, which anyone can come and fence, like if you wanted to come. Those fees that people pay for membership and intro class help fund the foundation. So it's kind of our base of money, that we try, and then everything else is grant-based and sponsorship. And Walmart and Sam's have given us small sponsorships, and Snyder's Lance has also. So those help kind of feed the other pot, of money to try to work with the foundation kids. And we have the children's shelter. They come in pretty much every week. We took a lot of the summer off between their schedule and ours, but we run them as many as 22 kids on a Saturday afternoon come in, and it varies. I mean, sometimes they'll do as a field trip, and sometimes on the weekend. It just depends, but they are welcome to come back when they are placed, whether back if they're able to go back with their family or with a foster family, then they automatically qualify for our foundation program to come back and fence. And then we also work with Big Brothers Big Sisters, so they can come in once a month, the Bigs and Littles. and they can fence. And we've done programming at the Jones Center and at the Boys and Girls Club.
The Northwest Arkansas Fencing Foundation helps underserved youth between the ages of 9 and 18 athletically through the sport of fencing. According to the foundation's website, the organization can provide up to 200 students of any skill level who meet the Department of Human Services guidelines for low-income families and who are enrolled in school to be selected for a competitive fencing program for 1 hour a week. 20 to 40 students who excel in the sport will be chosen for the full scholarship advanced program, which allows participants to train up to 6 days a week, receive private lessons, attend competitions, and receive all of the equipment necessary for training and competition. The foundation also offers a wheelchair fencing program for wheelchair users, as well as people with lower limb disabilities who are unable to fence traditionally. While it was her daughters who initially inspired her to start the fencing center and foundation, Laura says there's so much value in it for the community.
Fencing provides a great opportunity for college scholarships. Compared to football, basketball, soccer, and baseball, which you have about a 6% chance of getting a college scholarship, in fencing it's 50. So for us, it was the idea with a child who is on the free lunch program who maybe comes from a life where they've struggled or they've seen a lot of even pain. Depends on, you know, what the background is. If the parents are struggling and the children have lived that, it is really a way to change their life. I mean, it is. It provides, even on a basic level, even if they did not choose to go on to college or even to fence in college, it provides so many incredible character building traits. I mean, you know, really we instill, you know, honesty and perseverance, and there's a lot of dignity, and whether you're winning or losing, you have to have dignity and grace. You always honor your opponent with a salute at the beginning and the end of competition. You have to shake the hand of the person and basically thank them for the bout, even if you've just lost miserably. So there is a lot to it.
More information about the Northwest Arkansas Fencing Foundation is available at nwaff.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large, KUAF and Ozarks. Welcome Timothy Dennis to the Ozarks at Large staff this week. He's helping us produce our daily program Monday through Friday at noon, and each weekend he'll begin delivering a week in review.
Recycling was a prevalent topic in Fayetteville early last week. Tuesday night, the Fayetteville City Council gave the city's solid waste division the go-ahead to pursue a $25,000 grant. If approved by the state, the grant would be used to expand the city's apartment recycling program. The way the program works is simple. The city drops off a large roll-off style recycling dumpster at an apartment complex. The bin remains at the complex throughout the day for residents to source separate their tin and aluminum cans, glass bottles, plastics, mixed paper, and cardboard. The next day, the city picks up the container. Brian Pugh is the city's waste reduction coordinator.
This type of arrangement allows for us to use those containers at multiple sites, so we can get more apartment complexes participating in the program initially. And we would like to get to where we could leave these containers for a longer period of time eventually. Right now, we have two containers that we're using. We are about to receive three more containers that we actually got from a grant last year. And this grant for this year will be used for three more containers.
The money to start the apartment recycling program came from the state through the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District. Malin Rice, director of the Waste District, explains how the grant process works.
The grants are awarded to the Solid Waste Districts. Because the City of Fayetteville is a member of the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District, they're eligible for grant proceeds. They made an application, which has been approved at the district level by our board, and also that preliminary application, the funds will be released in late September, early October to the district, and then the city can purchase their equipment at that time.
Pugh says that there are currently five apartment complexes that are part of the program, which started last December. He also says that the program has been well received.
It's growing. We have a lot of apartment complexes that we've been talking to that we're trying to get them interested in participating. We also have some Energy Corps positions here in the city that have done education for us at the apartment complexes. So the awareness at the complexes that there is a service available for recycling is growing.
Although awareness and interest in the program has increased over the past 8 months, the program's success is not without its challenges.
The apartment complexes are very difficult in the respect of the turnover at the complexes. You always have new people moving in and new people moving out, and the educational aspect of keeping those people informed of that service and interested in participating is always a challenge. So working with the owners and managers and with our Energy Corps physicians doing promotional activities at these complexes, it's key to making this program work.
Also on the recycling front, 4 meetings with bar and restaurant owners were held Monday and Tuesday on Dixon Street. Up for discussion was Fayetteville's glass recycling pilot program in the Dixon Street area. The Ripple Glass Company of Kansas City has partnered with the City of Fayetteville on the project. Other partners include the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District and the Washington County Office of Environmental Affairs. 8 bars in the Dixon Street area are part of the pilot program. And as with the apartment recycling program, Pugh says that education is the biggest challenge. But that's where the program partners can help.
They'll be helping us with getting funding for the educational aspect of, you know, posters and table tents that are positioned on tables in the restaurants, and coasters and decals and all kinds of neat stuff that we can use inside these restaurants and bars to promote the program, and even containers that can be used to collect the glass inside those businesses. And then our focus, of course, will be on collecting that glass from the outside at the dumpsters or smaller containers that we're still trying to pilot with and try to figure out what works best in our operations and how we can do that.
Ripple Glass takes the bottles collected from Fayetteville and the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District. The company then sells the recycled glass to Boulevard Brewing Company and the Owens Corning Insulation Company. Aside from the obvious benefit of diverting glass bottles from the landfill, Rice says that the program offers another benefit.
We're closing the loop in this deal, in the recycling loop. Owens Corning Fiberglass in October will have determined how many tons of glass they picked up from the City of Fayetteville as well as Boston Mountain Solid Waste District, and then they will make a return gift of rolls of fiberglass insulation to be used by 501c3 organizations such as Habitat for Humanity. So the big winner in recycling all those beverage bottles and wine bottles and things off this portion of Dixon Street will be that a portion of those will be recycled into fiberglass insulation, which very well could end up in a Habitat for Humanity home in Washington County.
Both Pugh and Rice say there is no time frame for expanding the program. Pugh says the goal is to eventually expand to the rest of Dixon Street, to other parts of the city, and then to other areas in the Solid Waste District. Pugh says that the city is also working on a new solid waste and recycling resource management plan.
In this plan, it discusses such things as how our materials are collected, how they're processed, looking at different ways to collect materials and how best to do that. So if you're interested in that, the plan is actually posted online, but that is a draft version and has not been voted on by council, but the council will be looking at this and making decisions on how we are going to pick up our materials and how we're going to process it in the future and start allotting capital funds to work towards that.
The city's current recycling facility was built in 1996 around a source-separated recycling model. If the city decides to change to a single-stream system where cans, glass, paper, and cardboard are all mixed together, recycling participation would likely go up, but Pugh says that construction of a new recycling facility would be necessary. For KUAF and Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Again, Ozarks at Large welcomes Timothy Dennis. We'll be hearing from him each Sunday morning on Weekend Ozarks.
It's Sunday, August 12th, 2012. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I wish I knew more about music, but that's why I have Kevin Kinder, our music writer.
Because he knows just about everything there is to know.
He does, and he spoke last week with Miranda Lambert.
Lucky.
who is headlining the first Taste of Country Music Festival, which is Friday at the Amp.
I'm not that familiar with Miranda Lambert. I know that she's got a big following and is generally critically loved.
I'm going. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
I think her group Pistol Annie sounds like fun, too. Mm-hmm. She's also playing with her group. She says, you know, she's around 30, and Kevin tactfully asked her how that makes her music different.
Well, no, that's an interesting question.
It is. She said, people naturally change a lot during their 20s, so my songs reflect that progression, but she thinks she's still the feisty girl that she started out. She's also married to Blake Shelton.
Another country singer.
Yes.
So she says that her life is incredibly good and she's more settled, and she has songs on her new record like Safe and Oklahoma Sky that highlight those feelings.
This is a big get for Northwest Arkansas, right? I mean, she's one of the top draws in country music.
She is.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
And the rest of the lineup is the Pistol Annies. She's in that group. Randy Houser, Chris Knight, Adam Hood, and Amanda Kramer. The show is at 6 o'clock on the 17th. And tickets are $47 at the Walton Arts Center box office.
Okay.
Also this afternoon, the last performance of Weird Sisters.
Macbeth-inspired Arts Live performance.
For tweens and teens, about cliques and consequences and stuff like that at 2 o'clock. Tickets are $6 and $8. Last performance of Chicago at Rogers Little Theater. This show has been acclaimed all over the place, so you don't want to miss it. It's at 2 o'clock. Tickets are $16 and $45.
This ends, what, a three-weekend run for it? Yeah.
They continue the series A Joan for All Seasons about Joan of Arc at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library. And there is a great hall lecture by Los Angeles filmmaker Dale Shearholt.
Mm-hmm.
That's at 2 o'clock at Crystal Bridges.
All right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Decades of improvements to technology and much better research have led to more accurate weather forecasting. During the recent heat wave, Ozark's largest John Schlois trekked out into Northwest Arkansas to find a new piece that's creating the more accurate forecasts: local amateur meteorologists and their home weather stations.
It's 104 degrees in Prairie Grove, a small town west of Fayetteville in Washington County. Jerry Russell records this information all from the comfort of his desk chair in a nice house in the country. He has three dogs and a few cats. Some chickens and a guinea roam around outside. On top of Jerry's roof is a Davis weather station.
Basically, I moved to Northwest Arkansas 2 years ago. And, of course, you know, we have snow. I've come from San Antonio, which I'm not a whole lot of used to, a lot of snow. So I wanted something to be able to keep up with the temperatures and how much rain we get, and I just like the idea of the weather station.
Jerry is an unlikely candidate to be a meteorologist or someone who just keeps track of weather data, like
outside temperature is 104.2, inside temperature shows to be 77, outside humidity is 25%, inside humidity is 51%. I've got the barometric pressure is 29.85, slightly falling, there's an error there, no rainfall. Down below, it'll show you there's a heat index advisory.
Jerry got his weather station two Christmases ago. It was a gift from his wife. Last Christmas, he got the software.
It's interesting as all get out. I mean, as you know, since I've had it up now for 2 years, actually, since I have a software now since Christmas, you start collecting historical data to where you can always go back and see how much rain you have each month, or you can go back and see how much you had rain for each year, or you can compare it from this month to this time last year's, you know.
The station sits near the rooftop of the Russell's house. It's white and small and compact. It is a spinny contraption that collects the wind speed and a roosterless wind direction detector. These aren't very scientific terms. The station beams weather information wirelessly into Jerry's home office every few seconds. Halfway through our interview, Jerry actually received a phone call.
Oops.
He works from home for a forklift company in Texas. The guy on the phone asked Jerry how hot it is. It's 104.6 right this second, Jerry says. The guy on the phone asks Jerry if he can be more exact. Jerry laughs and reminds the caller that he's got a weather station sitting on his desk, and then he knows exactly how hot it is. All of Jerry's data, courtesy of Jerry's internet connection, is uploaded to wunderground.com, the main weather site for Weather Underground, a San Francisco-based company. I asked Toby Skinner, Weather Underground's vice president of marketing, about this, using data from personal weather stations to provide forecasts and precise temperatures for remote locations.
We actually switched only this year to our own proprietary forecast model to replace the National Weather Service forecast as our default forecast that we publish on wunderground.com. And keeping it very simple, if you think about forecasting, it's not an exact science, and to improve your forecast, you have to understand the error of the existing forecast so that you can work to improve it. And so, you know, to really be able to verify how well the forecasts are performing, you need actual data points. And nobody has more data points than our network provides us with.
Toby says Weather Underground uses data from personal weather stations, some 24,000 worldwide and 16,000 in the United States, to provide specific forecast models. At the time of our conversation last week, there were 281 active personal weather stations just in Arkansas alone. Toby says Weather Underground uses an algorithm to figure out which stations upload incorrect data. If a station is sending temperatures 40 degrees above other neighboring weather stations, it's probably a malfunction.
We've had over 60,000 stations sign up overall,
but only
over the last 10 years or so. But obviously, a lot of those have, you know, people have not maintained them, or they've moved, or they've just simply gone offline.
Right.
Obviously, weather stations, I'm afraid I'm not the expert on the hardware, so, but I, you know, they don't necessarily last forever.
One recently moved station was installed by Kobe Ward this spring. Kobe's a realtor for Realty Concepts. He installed the weather station at his parents' house on Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville.
It was, I moved back at the very beginning of the year, sometime about February, I guess. So it was about 2 months before I got up here from Texas and had it installed and was up and running again.
Right. Because, I mean, yeah.
That was a rough couple months.
Why? Why was it?
After 6 years of having this thing, I can look at it all the time. Plus, being winter, you know, it's during the summer, like right now, if it's not raining or storming, it's just freezing. It's just hot. But during the winter, when there's so much stuff that can go with a couple degrees difference, can happen between ice storms or sleet or snow, it's always nice to know what's going on.
Colby studied meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. He was fascinated by weather long before that.
I have been in love with weather for my entire life. Since I was old enough to get up and look out the window in the middle of the night, hearing thunder, you know, seeing lightning, I've always been completely fascinated by it. So for almost 34 years, I've been just always knew what was going on.
Colby Station is a bit larger than Jerry's over in Prairie Grove.
I guess it's called fan aspirated, so whenever the sun's directly on it, you're not getting this really bad heat reading. You've seen, like, bank signs, you're driving the streets reading, like, 112, you know, it's really only 95. It kind of keeps that under control.
There's a small funnel that collects rain, which runs in through the top of the unit and goes through a filter. It lands in a metallic seesaw, which, when it gets heavy enough, flips over and records a precipitation amount.
It's all automatic. It all falls in through here, through the screen, comes into this device right here, and every 1/100th of an inch, the cup will flip back and forth.
So
it automatically dumps it. And every time it does that, it registers rain. Huh. So right now we've registered probably, you know, 4 or 5 1/100ths of rain.
Toby says Weather Underground began collecting and publishing weather data from personal stations in 2001. 2 years later, in 2003, a Springdale man, Terry Slagle, began recording and uploading weather data from his subdivision just south of the Springdale Airport. The station sits in Terry's backyard and even records images using its built-in webcam. Terry's weather data is uploaded to wunderground.com, but also springdaleweather.com, which is a site Terry maintains. Terry says he got interested in weather when he lived in Florida, where the threat of hurricanes was constant.
Yeah, it just really got me interested in it because, you know, if you don't live along the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic Coast, hurricanes are sort of non-events to you. You know, living in Northwest Arkansas, you don't think too much about hurricanes or you worry too much about them. But just learning about hurricanes and you know, learning about how they form, why they form, and just looking at over the last 25 years, the amount of knowledge that's been gained about hurricanes is tremendous. But that's basically what got me interested. And over time, you know, these personal weather stations became more popular, and I just said, hey, I think that would be something interesting to do.
Terry has collected at least 8 years of historical data that is published on his website, springdaleweather.com. I asked him why. Why even bother replacing batteries, repairing equipment, checking internet connections, all to maintain this personal station? Why do all of this?
You know, I got to believe there's some other people out there that enjoy the weather too. You know, it's like I think about, you know, every morning when we get up, we may not care about or think about what's going on in Syria or what the stock market's going to do, but every one of us probably gets up in the morning and says, gee, I wonder what the weather's going to be today, or before we go to bed at night. You know, that's probably especially one news or information constant that we all have some degree interest in. People like me have more interest, and other people, they just want to know whether they got to wear a coat or carry an umbrella.
In early July, Weather Underground announced an agreement with the Weather Channel companies to buy Weather Underground. Toby, back over at Weather Underground, couldn't give out any specifics about the deal other than saying that Weather Underground was excited about the extra resources the Weather Channel would provide. I asked Toby if personal weather stations would play a role in this new relationship.
110%. I mean, you were asking about whether we use this for our marketing, and yeah, this community is our unique positioning of Weather Underground. They're our biggest brand advocates. They are, you know, they're telling their friends and their family, you know, I've got my weather station connected to Weather Underground. You must go and check out my, because they all have their own station pages on our site. So, you know, their community can all, you know, get their local data and their forecasts through our website.
That website again is wunderground.com. To find out information about personal weather stations, or to see links to the stations mentioned in this story, visit our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. For KUAF and Ozarks at Large, I'm John Schlois.
This afternoon, a few thousand people will gather at the campus of First United Methodist Church in downtown Springdale. It's the third year for the church's community block party. Even if you didn't attend last year's block party, you may have been affected if you tried to buy hot dogs in Springdale on a certain Sunday last August. Last year, the church prepared for between 300 and 500 attendees, but more than 2,000 people showed up.
So we were frantically running to the store and trying to clear out the shelves of everything extra that we needed, and we made sure that no one went without a nice warm meal that day.
That's James Ruth, a member of the church's congregation and a volunteer again this year for the block party. It's more than hot dogs and hamburgers. It's much more. At least 1,000 backpacks stuffed with school supplies are ready to be handed out. James Ruth says there will also be haircuts.
We have a number of area salons that are going to be there to participate, and we are going to try to service as many of the kids as we can.
Some local dental clinics will be there with services for adults and children, as well as tables devoted to immigration services. Jeannie Smith, co-chair of the block party, says the church wanted to make the Sunday afternoon event as much of a one-stop sort of service for families as possible.
And we'll have another table with items that families may need from the pharmacy that they can't necessarily afford, simple things like Tylenol and other things that we sometimes are able to give kids or families when they come into the Bread of Life, an organization with our church that is also, that is our food pantry. And so we'll have a table of non-prescription medicine and different things that people need. And we'll have the health department.
The state health department will be providing free inoculations. Parents may be thrilled to hear about these services involving shots, the dentist, and school. For kids, those might not be three subjects that sound like ingredients for a great summer Sunday afternoon. There will be games, a climbing wall, and other activities. Jeannie Smith says the basic idea for this third community block party is the same as the previous two. Break bread with neighbors. And those neighbors include people from all kinds of backgrounds.
As a community, we're very proud. I mean, it's just a wonderful place to raise kids for that reason. I love that my kids are in Springdale Schools, and everybody at church, we feel very blessed to be in this neighborhood. I don't know a lot of people outside of Springdale, outside of my world, that know as much about the Marshallese community as my kids do. I mean, my kids even speak a little Marshallese because they have gone to school with kids. So it's just a great community, a great neighborhood, and we do celebrate that about our neighborhood.
The First United Methodist Church qualified for money from the Arkansas Hunger Alliance grant to help pay for the food at the community block party. The grant is part of the nationwide No Kid Hungry campaign that churches and other organizations can apply for through the state.
What it does is encourage families to eat together. It's a summer feeding program where families can eat together. The schools have summer feeding programs, and now this grant, they're looking for applicants all over Arkansas. And we applied in June, and the community block party is covered.
This year, the community block party is anticipating 3,000 people, families from all around Springdale. James Ruth says he and the other 150-plus volunteers feel very prepared for this year's gathering. He says if other churches or organizations want to create something similar to the church in their community, that First United Methodist Church is willing to share their blueprint and what they've learned.
It has been an amazing event just watching strangers come together and act like they've known you for their whole lives, and you just have everyone there that's so appreciative of everything that we have to offer. And, you know, that's what I take from all of it, is just the smiles and the happiness, you know, from everyone.
The annual community block party at First United Methodist Church is this afternoon from 5 until 7. The free backpacks with school supplies will be handed out beginning at 4, and families will need to get there no later than 4 to receive the tickets for the backpacks. Jeannie Smith, the co-chair of the event, says all are invited today.
And we want to celebrate our community, so I can't think of a better way than maybe to just allow families to shop for something that maybe wouldn't be a fun experience otherwise. It's not a lot of fun when you don't have the money and you have to tell the teacher that you can't afford supplies at the last minute. And we saw a lot of families enjoying picking out their backpacks, just like we saw them enjoying getting their hair cut. It is as important to us as it is to the families. It's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to put that into words.
This is Ozarks at Law.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 12th of August, 2012. It was on this date, 1851, Isaac Marrett Sanger patented his first commercial sewing machine. He didn't invent the machine. He just made it more practical and efficient. His was the first to use an up-and-down needle movement instead of sideways, and it was powered by a foot treadle. And because Singer's sewing machine was a little bit expensive, he pioneered something else as well, the idea of buying on credit and making installment payments. It's the birthday of the filmmaker Cecil B. DeMille, born Ashfield, Massachusetts, 1881, made 70 movies between 1914 and 1956. He was known for lavish spectacles with the casts of thousands. His first was Joan the Woman, 1916, about Joan of Arc. 1923, he did The Ten Commandments, and then remade The Ten Commandments in 1956. And while he was filming on location in Egypt, Cecil B. DeMille had a massive heart attack. He rested for a week, and against his doctor's orders, he went back to work. He managed to finish the film, but it was his last, and he died in 1959. It's the birthday of the poet Robert Southey, born in Bristol, 1774. He was a member of the Romantic movement, one of the Lake poets in England, poet laureate for a time. He was a great rival of Lord Byron, who wrote parodies of Southey's poems, and Southey made fun of Byron, referred to him and his friends as the Satanic School of Poetry. Today we know Robert Southey for a couple of little things. He was the first to write down the fairy tale The Three Bears back in 1837, and he wrote the nursery rhyme, What Are Little Boys Made Of? And today is the birthday of Zerna Sharp, born in Hillsburg, Indiana, 1889. She was an elementary school teacher who created the Dick and Jane books for beginning readers. She was concerned about literacy. She felt the children would be more receptive to reading if the stories were about kids they could relate to. So in 1927, she came up with the idea of a young brother and sister, Dick and Jane, and she added their mother and father and their little sister, Sally, and Spot, the dog, and Puff, the cat, and wrote stories, simple stories in short, repetitive sentences. Run, Spot, run. Funny, funny Spot. Look, Dick, look, Jane. Books that entered the classrooms in 1930 and were routinely used until the late 1960s. Here's a poem for today by Ramon Montaigne, Nobody Loves You. Once I lived a life of some renown. People looked up to me in this town. They listened to what I had to say. I was well regarded at Bud's Cafe. Then one dark day they passed a law, no smoking, zero, nada, and I became persona non grata. Now I go out on the sidewalk to take a drag, me and the homeless lady with the garbage bag. Ginger Rogers smoked, and so did Fred Astaire, Clark Gable and Cary Grant, and nowadays you simply can't. People don't want elegance. They want clean air. Me and Bogey and Ernie Hemingway, Huck Finn, Woody Guthrie, Prince Andre, members of a noble, fatalist elite forced to stand out on the street. One cold day, I was talking to Chopin, who was shivering, smoking a cigarette, Turkish. Is this a decent way to treat a man who wrote those magnificent mazurkas? Nobody Loves You, a poem by Ramon Montaigne, used by permission of the poet here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Beaver Water District presents Secchi Day, a water education festival Saturday, August 18th from 9 until 1 at Prairie Creek on Beaver Lake. This family-friendly event will include a mobile aquarium, lunch, games, prizes, and more. Information available at 717-3807 or on the web at bwdh2o.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Jane, Missouri.
McCall County. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Have a good Sunday.
Happy Sunday.